Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next, JPR's Charlie Zimmerman offers a collection of short news features from around our region.
Where can you fly a plane, fight a wildfire, and dissect a human body all in the same place? At the Hall of Simulation in the Cal Poly Humboldt Library. JPR's Roman Battaglia reports this endeavor is part of an effort to connect with a local community.
Red Tower, 19013, ready to go, 34 at Alpha.
Dave Marshall is the advisor for the school's aviation club. He's taking off in a test flight from the Reading Airport today.
Number 19013, hotel Reading Tower, wind 320 at 9, gust 16, make left down departure, runway 34 clear for takeoff.
But he's not actually in Reading, and this isn't a real plane. It's a specialized simulator that recreates the cockpit of a Cessna 182. Sitting in one of the pilot seats, you have a 180-degree view of a low-resolution mock-up of the real airport, complete with fuel trucks that drive around the tarmac. Marshall says that aviation isn't as big as it used to be in Humboldt County. There are only around 50-odd pilots in the area, and the company that used to do pilot training shut down a few years ago. Marshall and a small group of enthusiasts are trying to revive the aviation industry here to bring back important benefits he believes are needed for the community.
Several of the air ambulance pilots got their primary instruction here. Several of the people that fly the CAL FIRE air attack or water bombers got their instruction here. That's no longer available. So that opportunity loss is going to be seen over the next 20 years.
The Aviation Club got this simulator as a donation around a year ago. It's now on the second floor of the Cal Poly Humboldt Library, where it's just one of the experiences you can discover at the Hall of Simulation. Library Dean Sorrell Oberlander says he wants his library to be inspiring to everyone, not just students.
Wikipedia taught libraries that knowledge can be co-created by everyone. And as a result, everyone benefits, everyone's engaged in it in a way that really has served communities very well.
The Hall of Simulation was created to centralize a number of different exhibits the library had been collecting for years. Diego Rodriguez-Willy is one of the student docents that helps people discover these simulators. He shows off his favorite one, the emergency table. A projector is displaying a map of Arcata and the surrounding forest on a large sandbox. Rodriguez-Willy shines a laser on one spot in the forest, and you can see a fire start to spread out.
We're expecting to see fire pretty much nearly one-to-one how you would expect fire to behave in reality if you were to set it here, with some caveats.
He says this table isn't just for playing around. You can assign simulated crews to fight the fire and practice finding out the best way to contain a wildfire all over the world. By making mistakes in this simulation, firefighters and emergency managers can learn how to avoid them in real life. But Rodriguez-Willy says people might not know how they can use tools like this if they aren't studying wildfire or medicine or aviation.
I think many would be willing to actually come up here if there was more information regarding some of the more tangible features or applications that they would benefit from using some of the features in the Hall of Simulation.
One example could be using the emergency table to simulate evacuation routes so someone can be more prepared in case a wildfire hits their community. Oberlander says they're working on piloting workshops this summer to teach people how they can use these simulators to learn more about the world around them. They can be especially valuable for kids who might get inspired to pursue a passion later in their lives. Nick Dedini, a middle school science teacher in Arcata, says he knows students and families that have come to use the space on their own.
I do know a student who used the flight simulator pretty regularly there and then applied to a school in Arizona out of high school and is now attending a flight school college in Arizona to get his pilot's license. And I know he spent a lot of time at that flight simulator and that was good for him.
Dedini says teachers are just now learning about this Hall of Simulation and how it can help them teach their students. That kid isn't the only one who's used the flight simulator in the library. According to Oberlander, community members used the simulator 105 times last semester. Shukri Iman is one of those community members. She was using the flight simulator while Oberlander was showing off the space. Iman is a traveling ultrasound technologist and just started her flight training a few months ago.
It's an amazing, amazing resource. Like, I'm surprised that more people don't take advantage of it because it's open to students and also the public, you know?
Oberlander is hoping to get the same response for the whole of the Hall of Simulation. His next project is an immersive tunnel to show 360-degree footage of nearby natural areas. Roman Battaglia, JPR News.
Across the nation, there are delays in the time it takes to process evidence that investigators collect after a sexual assault. In Oregon, for example, there are around 565 evidence kits waiting to be tested. California's backlog is so massive that leaders are unable to quantify it, but it is estimated to be around 14,000. In Colorado, the wait is 18 months, no better than at the start of the year when leaders in the state first became aware of the backlog. From the Mountain West News Bureau, Chaz Sisk lays out why crime labs are struggling to keep up.
In April, Kelsey Harbert sat before a panel of state lawmakers at the Colorado Capitol.
I am just a citizen pet sitter, don't work for anybody.
Harbert is also a survivor of sexual assault and this year a frequent witness at the state Capitol.
I testified along with another survivor who's actually stuck in the backlog 105 days ago in front of many of you, actually.
Throughout the spring, lawmakers have been hearing about the consequences of the backlog. Delayed prosecutions, victims waiting for closure. But Harbert was there to demand solutions, which she no longer believes the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, which oversees the state crime lab, is capable of providing.
Because at this point, every single time I personally have trusted CBI or taken their word for it, I have greatly regretted it.
When lawmakers first learned of the backlog at the CBI lab, many saw it as a troubling but temporary setback. One caused by unexpected turnover among the state's forensic scientists, and the claim that one of them, a scientist named Missy Woods, had manipulated results for more than a decade. The fix would be time-consuming, but seemingly simple. Review Woods' cases, hire some new scientists, outsource work while they get trained, and in a couple of years, everything would be back on track. But in recent weeks, lawmakers like Republican State Senator Lisa Frizzell have voiced fears that more is needed.
I don't always feel that there is a true recognition of the wake that has been left behind what I would consider some significant management issues.
It turns out Colorado is far from alone. Crime labs all over the country are struggling.
The resources are not keeping up with the demand for the service.
Jennifer Doliak is with a nonprofit called Arnold Ventures. She studies ways data can improve criminal justice. She says there are backlogs in all kinds of cases, from burglaries to murders. Sexual assaults are just the most visible. That's because over the past decade, the Department of Justice has spent $300 million getting crime labs to test sexual assault kits that had previously sat moldering in police vaults. States, in turn, passed new laws to prioritize sexual assault kits.
And it's actually created this huge problem in the crime labs that now, because they don't have any more resources than they did before.
Meanwhile, prosecutors and law enforcement have a growing appetite for DNA testing. And the technology has improved enormously, even faster than government spending on staffing and equipment.
We get what we pay for, basically.
The Missy Woods case illustrates the pressure on crime labs. Woods won accolades for being a top performer. Investigators were told she returned twice as many results as the next fastest scientist. There were suspicions she cut corners, yet there was such an emphasis on productivity, scientists worried they'd be fired if they couldn't keep up.
We are asking too much of laboratories without providing resources to do what they are asking them to do at the level they're asking them to do it. And so something has to give.
Dr. Laura Gadash-Combs spent two decades in crime labs, from New York to New Mexico. Now she's an associate professor at the University of New Haven in Connecticut.
I think there are so many laboratories where people are on the verge of breaking, if they're not silently breaking already.
Combs says fixing the problem will take more than money. It'll require giving labs a way to push back on unreasonable workloads and to tell political leaders outside the lab what they need as DNA technology continues to evolve. For KUNC, I'm Chaz Sisk.
One of the new laws approved in this year's Oregon legislative session gives people with a family member in memory care the right to establish independent councils to advocate for their loved ones. KLCC's Rachel McDonald reports.
It's not that often that a couple of ordinary Oregonians who don't work in government are successful in getting a law passed in Salem. But two Eugene area residents were the forces behind the legislation. Jewel Nelson and Judith Smith met in 2019 when each of their mothers moved into memory care at the Rollins in Springfield. Soon after, COVID hit. Nelson says she learned you don't know what you don't know.
One thing we do know is that the residents themselves, because of suffering from these diseases, have no voice of their own, no ability to advocate for themselves. Everybody all over the country was struggling. And in these facilities, everything was all in a panic, and there was a real nightmare going on with staffing, with visits to the windows, with lacks of information and accessibility to our loved ones who were totally confused and already suffering.
The Rollins started offering town halls on Zoom for loved ones and family, but Nelson says she and Smith wanted something else. With help from the local ombudsman, they started to meet on a regular basis without Rollins' staff.
But it became an invaluable touchstone for providing support, community, education, and advocacy for each other, all the family members who attended these council meetings.
They brought in special guests, including experts on topics like hospice, Medicaid, Alzheimer's, and more. Smith says through the family council, she found a community. Management was only able to attend by invitation, so it gave space to speak freely.
If the facility, for example, had a systemic issue, we could bring that forward to them. Some people are afraid to talk about these things because they might be singled out, and maybe they're not heard. So we, as a family council, could write a letter or stand behind someone. And with the ombudsman, our deputy ombudsman, facilitating the meetings, she has all the answers.
Then in 2023, both their moms died within a few months of each other, and the Rollins got a new manager who told them the family council was no longer meeting and they would start a management-run support group. Smith says this was a rude surprise.
I thought that we had rights. I thought independent family councils had rights because there's a publication called the Consumer Voice that addresses that, but then we found out that that's a federal law for nursing homes. And I said, why isn't there a law in Oregon to protect family councils?
Nelson says she was invited by a family member to the management-run support group Zoom meeting, but she wasn't allowed into the Zoom. After that, they reached out to the state ombudsman, Fred Steele, and told him what happened. He offered his support for legislation to protect independent family councils. Nelson says that was a relief.
It was a perfect wedding of, you know, shared concerns and a boost to accidental activism on our parts. Because as you said, it's not our background. We're not lobbyists. We're not anything. So we started down this path.
They did some digging and found out that California has a law protecting family councils. They put together some language for a proposed bill. They met with Senator James Manning of Eugene, who agreed to carry the bill. They spent many days visiting with lawmakers in Salem to share their story. The process was intimidating. Nelson says many legislators were surprised independent family councils weren't already protected by Oregon law.
Because what we found was, if there wasn't a law, that the choice whether to allow an independent family council in a facility was totally up to the whim of management.
After hearings and all the processes it takes for a bill to move forward, Senate Bill 228 was approved by the Oregon House and Senate. No one voted against the bill in either chamber. Governor Tina Kotek signed it into law on May 28th. Smith says she wanted this for every family in Oregon who has a loved one in memory care.
Having that sense of community, it really means a lot. And I think through family councils that their loved ones' voices can be heard. And this, I said, this is not for my mother because she's not here anymore, but it's in memory of my mother.
Nelson says it's fitting that photos of each of their mothers are on the one-pager explainer sheet they handed out to lawmakers during the session.
These are the women who were a catalyst for who we're protecting and who we are advocating for, who have lost their ability to speak for themselves. So that's why it's all important.
Nelson and Smith are now prepared to spread the word about family councils to people who have loved ones in memory care. I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene.
And that's it for today's JX. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more. Or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike Green.